the blizzard is still coming. Do you get to 100% when you are getting into the maximum impact of the disease, or we might have to maybe stop at a certain percentage, which would be safe enough for us to operate?
It will never be business as usual, as South African mines slowly ramp up operations amid the COVID-19 pandemic. How do companies ensure that their workers are safe, yet still ensure a profitable operation? Just how do mines operate in the new normal? Hi, I'm Laura Cornish, Editor-in-Chief of Mining Review Africa, and welcome to Deep Insights, our weekly podcast. This week, Senior Editor Gerard Peter chats to Dr. Tutule Balfour, Head of Health at Minerals Council South Africa, about the impact of COVID-19 on the South African mining industry. Was the national lockdown necessary? What can mining companies do to safeguard their workers? How do they protect mining communities? And what can we expect in a post-COVID-19 mine? Let's join the discussion.
Dr. Balfour, thank you for joining us on Deep Insights today. Now, mining companies had already put in place procedures to stop the spread of COVID-19 prior to the national lockdown. So why was there a need to halt operations?
I think it is a complex decision to take regarding at what stage do you halt production. And we started reporting cases in around April. Or late March of this year, and right up to about 21 cases, you know, we hadn't had any halting of operations, which we thought was quite insightful and not a knee-jerk reaction on the part of the department, you know, the inspectorate, the Department of Minerals and Energy. And I'm saying that because a few times one did see one case in the non-mining sector, and you'd hear that a facility has been shut down. What I did actually was to ask the chief inspector of labor, you know, under what circumstances do you decide to shut down when there's one case? And he said, it's when we go there and in our inspection, we find that you don't have things in place to prevent COVID. So even if it's one case, if your systems are such that you are not ready to prevent the disease, then we shut you down, which I truly understood, you know, because it means that workplace is not ready and will continue to have cases of COVID. I suspect then what happened in our sector is that maybe most of the time, when the DMRE did visit, they did find that the systems were in place. It was a once-off case, you know, that was found.
Are mining companies adequately prepared for COVID-19?
I believe that most of our companies really are fairly ready, and it's because they, prepared very early on and put systems in place. An example, you know, we advise them, get your PPE now, get your flu vaccines now in February. The flu vaccine they couldn't get because it only arrived in the country around April. But with PPE, I think most of them managed to procure, you know, and you know the rush that went on in the whole country where everyone was looking for PPE. So I think it was quite useful that our companies were ready, they had systems in place, you know, for managing and controlling, or in fact preventing, because that is our key approach. We believe that you cannot out-treat the disease. Many countries, big countries, rich countries, could not out-treat the disease. And so for a country with no resources like ours, the prevention is even more important, you know. So we believe that we've done well in that space of prevention.
Doctor, can you tell us about the standard operating procedure that the Minerals Council suggested to companies, and how effective has this been?
As a Minerals Council, we are a member-serving organization. And so we don't regulate our members, for instance. We cannot impose on them. We merely provide standards, advice that they can then use in the development of their own standard operating procedures. So what had happened was that ideally the DMRE should have come through with a guidance fairly early. They came through with their guidance later around the end of March, and they now have the formal approved guideline, because there is a difference between a guidance and a guideline. A guidance is a document you can refer to, but you are not obliged to follow, which is why we then ended up with the court application that there should be a guideline, which means it is binding on members. And so we've had that now published as of yesterday. So as the Minerals Council, you know, this was a new disease, and we felt that it's important to guide our members, which is why then we put out those SOPs. Some were more about the prevention, others about the management of cases on your mind, and we also had another one on the return to work after the lockdown. And we've also provided other guidance on PPE, you know, which employees are more at risk than others, and what type of PPE they should be given. And we are now about to finalize one on vulnerable populations, which talks to, you know, in a country where we've got a high incidence of HIV, high incidence of hypertension, diabetes, non-communicable diseases generally, how do you then as a company go about, you know, trying to protect those employees? There's also age. So how do you protect those employees so that we ride out the epidemic with the minimal loss, you know, of employee lives?
Doctor, was the Minerals Council part of drawing up these guidelines?
Yes. In mining, we have a very strong tripartite relationship between the state, unions, and employers. So we were part of the drafting of the guideline. And so we are quite, you know, satisfied with the outcome of that process. Even the unions were part of the drafting of the guideline.
The mining industry is no stranger to pandemics and illness such as HIV, dealing with TB, and has had considerable success. How have these experiences assisted you in dealing with the current COVID-19 pandemic?
They have definitely assisted us. I mean, compared to other industries where maybe you don't have fairly high levels of disease. For instance, like you say, TB in mining is an occupational disease, and we've been managing TB for more than a century, as an occupational disease. And some of the experiences have been of value. For instance, we've got a reporting system, you know, for diseases, both the occupational diseases in the industry, and we've been doing that for the past 5 years. You know, we've had that system in place, so it's really made it easy for us to convert and just add on a module on COVID. So already we do have now a reporting system on the cases of COVID that have been diagnosed by our members, and also on the screening. We know when the lockdown, after the lockdown, there was a lot of screening that had to be done, and there is going to be screening going forward. So our members also, you know, we have weekly reports of how many employees have been onboarded, and how many have been screened, and how many had to be tested, and, you know, the outcomes of those tests. So the close monitoring of employee health is or second nature to us, really. And so it's because of the experience, as you say, that we have gained over the years. I think we also appreciate the fact that any disease, if you are to control it, you need to go beyond the mind gate. So when we advised our members regarding their plans for COVID, we specifically encouraged them to collaborate with the district authorities, you know, the Department of Health. Because the disease, you might do everything within the mind, but if the worker goes back to the community and the disease is circulating in the community, then you are not going to win the battle. So we encouraged collaboration, and a number of the companies are involved in such, where there's a fairly regular interaction with the Department of Health so that they know where the cases are. And most importantly, that the companies then are able to assist the department, you know, on some of the areas where there are gaps. There are companies that have provided PPE, you know, when there was a crisis with the health professionals not having PPE. Some of the companies assisted there. There's companies that have offered, you know, quarantine beds, isolation beds to the district so that the district has got access, you know, where required, to those facilities. Even food parcels, you know, with the lockdown, the extension of the lockdown and the serious socioeconomic circumstances people find themselves in, some of the companies are providing food parcels, you know, to communities, sanitization, face masks. So there's a lot, really. In fact, I always say, when it comes to COVID, you can't have any one stakeholder being able to adequately address the disease. It has to be a collaborative, you know, approach between both the public sector and the private sector. It's the only way. As South Africans, in fact, all South Africans, we need to make a contribution if we are to, you know, survive COVID.
Doctor, social distancing is the new norm. But how do you ensure social distancing in an industry where employees rely on their peers to engage physically with them in order to keep safe in minds?
That's quite a valid, you know, question. In fact, in our mining industry, we do know that social distancing in some instances is a huge challenge, whether it's 1 meter or 2 meters, you know, in terms of that social distancing. And that's why then we decided that because we cannot absolutely guarantee social distancing, we then need to provide better protection, you know, for our employees. So our guideline, for instance, is that for employees that have their normal PPE being dust masks, they can use those, which are very efficient in filtering out, even organisms. And then for any other employee who does not have a mask issued as part of their standard PPE, then all of those have to be issued with surgical face masks. Now, you know, there is the requirement that all South Africans should be using cloth face masks. We felt that it's not adequate for our employees because cloth masks are not as efficient as, you know, surgical face masks. They are good for you, of course, because a cloth mask is far better than nothing. But because of the likelihood of some areas, you know, dense, what we call there are dense areas, then we felt we need to provide the best protection, and that was in the form of the surgical face masks, which is what we are using now for our employees.
Doctor, 19 cases were detected recently at Marula Mine in Limpopo. Clearly, COVID-19 is going to be around for some time. So how do we deal with these clusters going forward?
It's a great challenge. And in fact, all of those people were asymptomatic. And that's the biggest worry, you know, around this disease. Some stats say up to 40% of people who carry the condition, the disease, are asymptomatic. So actually, it does pose a very a big challenge if these people are asymptomatic. We do hope that, you know, through the screening, at least that, you know, when, because a person may report that maybe they don't feel feverish, but we hope that at least when you measure their temperature, you know, it will show. It does mean that, you know, whenever there is maybe a case, we need to dig a bit deeper and see if we can't test a little bit more. And that again poses a challenge for South Africa, because right now the country is running short of test kits. You know, the NHLS committed to test 30,000 people per day. And they've slowly ramped up. They are on about 20,000 now, but it's still not at the level at which they would want to be. And their key constraint is test kits. They've got the machinery, but the test kits are not there. And it's not just a shortage in South Africa. It's a global, you know, shortage of test kits. But I think that the industry is looking at how maybe it can also come up with a, you know, augment the testing capacity in the country. And we hope, you know, we can land on something in terms of agree on what exactly we will do. We already have companies that were proactive, which ordered, you know, machines early in the year, Anglo American being one. They ordered machines which have now arrived. And so they do have extra testing capacity. And I think we see that as very important in the industry, in that, you know, we are still on very early in the epidemic. We are in May. By June, towards July, we are really going to be seeing a very high rate of infection. And so the testing will come in, will become very important, especially where you are now trying to really keep out the infected people so that you don't have epidemics, you know, or outbreaks as we have, as we saw, you know, in the Marula mine.
Dr. Earlier this year, the mining companies said that they would open up their hospitals to help cope with the overflow of COVID-19 patients. Is this still the case now that some operations have resumed?
It's still the case at the moment. It, you know, things evolve. For instance, we now have in our new regulation a requirement that, you know, people who are from epicenters should be quarantined for 14 days. Now, that's something we had not planned on in terms of, you know, the number of beds that we had provided for, because those people need to be in specific facilities and they are monitored. We actually might now have to utilize some of those beds when we need to ramp up. For instance, some of the mines are at 50% capacity in terms of functioning because of the level four that we are at. And when they then need to ramp up to whatever is decided on at level three, when they are bringing in people, it now means that they need to be quarantining people for 14 days. And so with that new requirement, you know, we can't be absolutely certain that in terms of capacity, we are still going to have, you know, the required capacity that we initially thought we would have. But as I say, you know, it's something that we're going to see as it evolves. And we hope that we would still be able to support, you know, the public sector, you know, with any spare capacity in the industry.
Mm-hmm. Doctor, let's talk about ramping up. And the big question is, when will it be safe for underground mining operations to go 100%?
Very difficult question. I guess there'll be a lot of factors that are considered in that. And unfortunately, we actually are still going into the real epidemic, you know, because in South Africa, our epidemic was, it started early on, mainly driven by in contact with people from the Northern Hemisphere who were in their winter. We are still getting into our winter. And, you know, I keep saying the blizzard is still coming, you know. And so it's going to be very difficult to say when we are opening up whilst the epidemic is really now ramping up on its own. You know, it's going to be very difficult now to balance that. Do you get to 100% when you are getting into the maximum impact of the disease, or we might have to maybe stop at a certain percentage, which would be safe enough for us to operate. But these are all the unknowns, you know, of this epidemic. No one has got answers, but we have to take decisions as we go along. So that's what we will have to be doing going forward.
Doctor, in light of the pandemic, is zero harm still achievable by the end of this year?
Well, zero harm under normal circumstances, we are still committed to that. You know, in terms of this epidemic, it's for all of us. It's not just mining. So, you know, any additional fatalities in the mining industry due to this disease, it will be, you know, similar to, and or we hope will be even better than, you know, the rest of the country. Because if we are putting in all these measures, we do hope that it will bring us that dividend that we will have minimal deaths and would be able to protect our employees, you know, so that we weather the epidemic.
Now, Doctor, it will never be business as usual for mines. Can you paint us a picture of what mining operations will look like in a post-COVID-19 world?
Our experience, you know, during the epidemic will probably shape how we look after the epidemic. For instance, the issue of vulnerable employees will be quite big in terms of the impact. We've got, you know, in South Africa, very high levels of the diseases that actually lead to severe forms of COVID-19. And we will need to, as I say, protect those employees as far as we can. And in some cases, they might have not to work, so that, you know, we protect their own lives, which means that they would then be able to come back once the epidemic has settled. I think probably the biggest impact of the epidemic will come through from the impact of the lockdown. You know, we are locking down to protect a certain number of lives, but the lockdown itself has got major socioeconomic impacts. So, you know, people talk about a shrinkage of GDP in South Africa of about 10%, 15%, depending on the levels at which we will maintain our lockdowns. You know, those impacts are going to be far longer term, you know, in terms of their impact on people's health. Because if people do not have a livelihood, then it's difficult for them to maintain good nutrition. And so even in terms of 2 years from now, we might even see the impact of, you know, the lockdowns because of the ripple effect from the economic consequences, you know, which will then translate into the socioeconomic conditions that we'll find. And unfortunately, you know, this comes at the worst of times for South Africa, at a time when we already were on almost our knees, you know, with very little savings. In fact, we are in debt. Imagine a person who is in debt, and then something like this comes in, and you actually maybe even have to go and borrow when you can't even afford to pay for the debt that you have. So I think then the consequences really are going to be more from the socioeconomic impacts going forward, the impoverishment of our communities, and the high rates of expectations, which will probably be placed on minds, because they will be there in a community which is even more impoverished than what it was before. And already, you know, before we went into this, the minds, there's been a lot of, you know, expectations from communities, from the districts, from the provinces. And so if we had that demand already, it's mind-boggling to think what will be there, you know, in a post-COVID scenario where the communities are now even more impoverished.
Finally, Dr. Balfour, what is one word of advice you can give to employees, employers of the mining industry, and the general public out there to stay safe and limit the spread of COVID-19?
You know, I'll start off with the public, because we all interact with the mines are within communities. And my advice is, all of us, let us follow the advice that has been given to utilize masks in public and ensure that we limit our interaction at a social level, because that is also a great transmitter of the disease. So for the short term, let's forfeit, you know, some of the social activities we would have had. And for the mines, I would say that it's critical for the mines to work collaboratively with their employees, so that the employer-employee relationship, you know, is one of trust, and everyone is working towards prevention of the disease on the mine. We cannot fight COVID if the mine workers themselves are not trusting the employer. So trust and working together are going to be very critical for both the mine worker and the employer to make sure that all of us get through this disease.
Dr. Tutula Balfour, Head of Health at the Minerals Council South Africa, thank you very much for joining us on Deep Insights today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. Please remember to subscribe to our weekly podcast, which is available on all popular podcast platforms. Give us a 5-star rating and share Deep Insights with your social network. Also, log on to miningreview.com to access our webinars, videos, industry insights, and the latest mining news. Until next week, goodbye and stay safe.